This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
We have to sort of change our culture a little bit to adapt to that, rather than everybody carrying around a mug so that they can walk with a mug instead of a paper cup. Slow down, sit down, smell the coffee and enjoy it.
What do cork, coffee cups, lettuce, and excessive travel have in common? They're all areas of personal choice that have an environmental impact, and they're all things we'll be discussing with our guest today on Sea Change Radio. Lloyd Alter is a design professor as well as an editor at treehugger.com. This week he joins us and expounds on the virtues of cork, a surprisingly sustainable alternative to fossil fuel-based products for soundproofing, insulation, home building, and of course, bottling wine. We also talk about the waste generated by ubiquitous coffee to go, the diminishing need for travel in the era of electronic communication, and what Alter posits to be the idiocy of lettuce. As many of us think about making New Year's resolutions for 2019, Alter gives us some ideas as to what we might put on our lists.
Yo, the jam was fly. Yo, my, now it's over. My batcher, pals, cut so tight. They must catch a taxi cab. Dag them. Why'd they leave me? Stuck in the late night app. Cali's not so hot that everyone should be sweating. Yet nobody's smiling. Bless cruiser pilot.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Lloyd Alter. Lloyd is a design editor at treehugger.com and an adjunct professor at Ryerson University in the School of Interior Design. He's based in Toronto, Canada. Lloyd, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Pleasure to be here.
Excited to speak to you. I've read your stuff for quite some time on Treehugger. You have a piece that struck a chord with me called "Is Cork the Perfect Green Building Material?" Now, 6 or 7 years ago, we had Andrew Revkin from the New York Times environmental section, longtime environmental journalist and educator, who was on the show talking about a documentary filmmaking project on the sustainability of cork. And this was talking about the movement towards synthetic corks and getting away from cork in wines. But your angles resonated with me for a number of reasons. Why don't you first kind of take us to how you came across the idea for the piece and maybe give us a quick summary.
Well, one of the key things that's been changing over the last couple of years is the recognition that making those plastics that Andrew would have talked about as replacing corks, in fact, is a huge problem, that plastics are basically solid fossil fuels, and we have to stop using them and switch to renewable materials. So in building construction, that means replacing concrete and steel with more wood. And with insulation, you know, everybody's been filling their walls with plastic foams for so many years, and all of those plastic foams have a huge embodied carbon in making them and in the propellants that are used to blow up the air in them. Whereas cork is from a tree, it's totally renewable, it's actually a really fabulous insulator, it doesn't burn. There are so many properties to it that make it far better than any artificial synthetic plastic insulation that we otherwise would be using. So also what had been happening over the years with this movement in the actual wine cork industry to plastics is that we were beginning in Portugal and Spain to lose the forests, which are habitats for the Iberian lynx and other animals, which employ 10,000 people in the forest. They were being lost basically to holiday developments. So actually using cork is preserving the forests, preserving the jobs, and making this incredible renewable resource that is the cork itself.
And you have some terrific pictures here. I didn't realize the scale of cork production. Maybe you can kind of give us a little snapshot of the production and the scalability of this tree.
Well, the production is quite amazing. Again, when they used to, decades ago, before the 73 oil crisis, cork was primarily used for wine corks. And they also, through this process that was developed in New York City by accident, where they figured out that if you heat the cork pellets together under steam and heat, they actually, the natural resin in them puts it all together into a block that is a terrific insulating panel. It can be sliced up into sheets. And nobody cared much about it when energy was free, but suddenly in the energy crisis, the cork company, Amorim, the big cork producer in Portugal, started seriously getting into the insulation business. And again, it took many years for it to get popular because plastic insulations cost half as much. And cork actually had a bad name. People were worried, oh my God, we can't be chopping down the trees. But you're not chopping down the trees. You're just peeling it off. Every 9 years, you look at the trees and they all have a number on them, which is the year it was last harvested. And then in 9 years, you trim it again and you've got the cork. And you can do that for approximately 200 years on the tree.
And that's what's really exciting about it, is this is so different than other wood usage.
Yes.
It's more like making maple syrup almost than chopping down trees for paper.
That's a really good analogy, because the tree does survive and the tree continues growing. And when they got into making the insulation, they could use more of the cork than just the stuff they needed for wine corks that had to be, about 2 inches thick for them to actually punch out the cork. So now they can use smaller pieces, all the leftover waste. They take it, they let it dry out for a few months, then they just steam it and press it into these blocks and cut it up. It's simple. They use the cork dust they feed into their furnaces, so they're not using any electricity or fossil fuels to make it, and it's basically carbon neutral. The only real carbon footprint in the whole use of cork insulation is the shipping it from Portugal to North America, and since they're going by boat and it's very light, it's a deal. You prefer to use a local product, but it's not a big deal comparison to the footprint of making it out of fossil fuels.
So you mentioned how plastic foam insulation is much less expensive. And that wasn't always the case, of course. These plastics scaled, the industry expanded, and prices fell.
Right.
What would have to happen for cork to be able to start competing? Right now, you write that it's about twice as much as plastic foam, but would it have to be grown elsewhere besides Portugal and Spain? Or do you think that those countries have enough capacity to really start competing right there?
They could possibly increase their capacity. What has to be done, I think, is really on the other side, that we have to put a price on carbon, that we have to make the fossil fuel companies pay the freight for all the damage that is caused and the carbon that is produced. And if there was a price on carbon, then the plastic foams would in fact cost a lot more, and the cork would begin to be more comparable and more competitive. But unfortunately, as long as carbon is free and the fossil fuel companies rule the world and the United States is fracking so much natural gas, it's going to be a while till that happens.
In your research for this piece, Lloyd, did you come across any disinformation campaigns of any sort coming from, let's say, the plastic industry? I hearken back to the plastic disposable diaper industry, which there was kind of a push to go back to cloth diapers and stay away from disposable diapers for obvious reasons. But then the disposable diaper industry paid for all of these. They muddied the waters with research that said, well, it uses much more water, and so your carbon footprint's going to be worse with reusable cloth diapers, which is preposterous. But did you see anything similar with the cork versus plastic?
I don't believe it has happened yet, because the cork is such a niche product. So few people know about it or ask for it that I don't think it's on their radar. I don't think that they'd bother. They've got the traditional construction industry and the traditional builders. I don't think use enough cork that they would even notice.
And has the wine industry kind of switched away from synthetic corks back to traditional corks, or is that still underfoot, that transition?
No, there is a lot of people, a lot of wineries that have absolutely decided that in the end, the cork, the natural cork product is better, that it's there is the risk of sometimes the wine being corked, of a cork leaking some air. But they also found that there is a natural breathing through the cork that actually helped the wine age properly. So I believe there's been a movement back to traditional solid corks.
People been asking me, where'd you learn to fly that way? It's over in Vietnam, chasing NBA. The government taught me, and they taught me right. Stay down under the tree line, you might be alright. Treetop flyer.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with Lloyd Alter. He is a design editor at treehugger.com, and he's also an adjunct professor at Ryerson University School of Interior Design in Toronto. So, Lloyd, we were talking about the scale and whether cork can be planted elsewhere. You interviewed somebody named Carlos Manuel, who said that cork trees can start producing within 10 years with new irrigation technology. Is this a real breakthrough in the industry? Has this been something that has kind of been available to farmers for years? They just haven't seen much of a demand for it.
No, it is a breakthrough. As he was explaining to me, if they want to expand the cork trade, the cork industry, when before this irrigation process, it took 20 years before they could actually get cork off the tree. And if you're a farmer, 20 years is a very long time to plan
sure.
ahead. You know, you can't think, oh, yeah, right, I'm going to plant this now, and in 20 years, I'm going to have a business.
Unless you're making a single malt scotch or something like that, right?
Yes. But in fact, when they figured out this irrigation process that they actually could start harvesting cork in 10 years, it dramatically changed the economics for these farmers. And a lot of them have been getting back into growing cork oak trees there, thinking, well, 10 years, you know, that's a window where I'll be alive or my kids can get into it more quickly. And the wonderful thing about this, I asked specifically, what about are the kids leaving the farms like they all, of course, did in North America as farms got all mechanized and you needed fewer and fewer people? And he said, no, the industry is thriving and the farmers who are growing their trees, their kids are staying. And so it's really a great thing, in fact, that they've been able to get this window down from 20 years to 10.
So beyond insulating one's home, what other kind of uses are there for cork beyond just competing with insulation and for bottling wine?
Well, it's also a fantastic soundproofing. I, in fact, have cork. When I renovated my house, I have sheet cork under the flooring upstairs so that it absorbs the footfalls. It's a very good insulation, sound insulator as well. The other thing that we're going to be seeing more and more is that people are really becoming obsessed with healthy homes. And cork is antibacterial. So, for instance, they also have a product where they mix really fine 1 millimeter cork in with plaster, and you plaster that on top of cork wall, and suddenly you have a white plastered wall that looks kind of like drywall or a finished wall, but in fact is smell and noise absorbing and porous and breathing, which the cork does. So it could be a really healthy material, a really great wall. For instance, some people are really, really sensitive to chemicals and really allergenic. It might be very good for them because it's that totally kind of natural material.
And you mentioned that it's still kind of a niche building material, Lloyd.
Yes.
If a listener wanted to act on this interview and go down to a Home Depot or wherever, would they be able to find cork? And if not, where can they find it?
I was in a green building supply company that services most of the West Coast, which name I can't remember right now, out of Olympia, Washington, and they'd imported a ton of cork, and they had a whole wall of it. There's quite a few green building supply companies that stock cork because the serious green builders actually use quite a bit of it. They're the main users of it in North America. So I wouldn't say Home Depot, but if you look up green building supply places, I bet they have it.
Speaking of some of the things that listeners can do to change their carbon footprint and to not only help the planet, but to help themselves in terms of leading a healthier lifestyle, it's always a good time at the end of the year to kind of do a check on your own consumption habits. Why don't we go through some of the things that you've written about recently and talk about how listeners might be able to make a difference? Why don't we start with coffee cups? It sounds like a simple little thing for the coffee addicts out there who drink a cup of coffee every day. Where are they making a mistake and how can they improve their habits?
Well, the single biggest problem that we've got is the disposable cup, because the disposable cup is mostly non-recyclable. They're lined with a plastic so they don't get soggy and leak. If the plastic lid is attached to the paper cup, then somebody's got to actually separate them. They can recycle the lid, but not the cup. This uses a lot of energy and a lot of water to make the paper. And the plastic lids are another one of those sources of plastics that are getting into the ocean and are causing all the problems we have. And the liners probably are disintegrating and becoming a microplastic. Fundamentally, plastics are a huge problem in so many ways, from A, the fact that they're made from petrochemicals, and B, that they're all ending up in our babies, in our animals, in our fish, and in our water. So this is the main thing. Now, a lot of companies are trying to figure out this sort of circular economy way. You know, how do we take the cup back? How do we, some are putting chips in the bottom of plastic cups so you can take it and they can recover the cup. And it's all crazy. You know, we perfectly knew how to have a cup of coffee 50 years ago. You went to the coffee shop, you sat down, you drank it out of a China mug. And this is what we have to, I think, we have to change our coffee culture, not just our cup. And we have to stop thinking that we have to walk down the street with a paper cup, but in fact that we should sit down and enjoy it, which is what Schultz, when he founded Starbucks, thought it would be, the third place where you'd go and actually have a cup of coffee.
Wow, that's a radical idea that I hadn't really thought of. I do remember my grandfather around 15 years ago, who was already in his late 80s, remarking at these people who had walked by, some with coffee cups and some with their water bottles. And he was like, when did everybody get so effing thirsty? I just thought that was like, you have to constantly be hydrating while you're walking. But the idea of actually drinking a cup of coffee while you're not on the move is a pretty revolutionary one, I guess.
Well, and the water thing, you know, he was absolutely right. We've been totally sold a bill of good about this constant need to be hydrated and carried bottled water everywhere. And again, for years we've been complaining about bottled water because of the water, and this is so stupid. Water's almost free, and it's perfectly safe, and it's perfectly good in most municipal water systems, probably better than the bottled water. And the point now that I keep stressing over and over again, it's the plastics. It's the single biggest single-use plastic product. And to make that, you've got to have natural gas. And this is, according to the GASC, the producers, 30% of all the oil and natural gas in 15 years, as more people drive electric cars, as much as 30% of all the fossil fuels are going to be going into plastics. And most of those go into single use. So this is what we have to stop with the constant hydration. The disposable bottles have to go and the disposable cups have to go. And we have to sort of change our culture a little bit to adapt to that, rather than everybody carrying around a mug so that they can walk with a mug instead of a paper cup. Slow down, sit down, smell the coffee, and enjoy it.
That's not a bad New Year's resolution for a lot of people out there as well.
Yes, sir.
This is Alex Wise on SeaChange Radio. I'm speaking to Lloyd Alter. He's the design editor at treehugger.com. So, Lloyd, you've chronicled a lot of things under the umbrella of the passive house movement.
And right.
Why don't you first explain what that is, and then I want to dig into a piece that you wrote called "Should We Just Stop Flying to Conferences?" Which it seems kind of like a rhetorical headline, because yes, we definitely don't need to be going to all these conferences, but it's interesting when there's some of the greenest businesses that make the bulk of their money on conferences, bringing people together from all over the world to talk about things like not flying to conferences.
Right. And this was the hilarious thing about that post, because I was flying to a conference to discuss passive houses, which is a form of building designed to reduce your carbon footprint. And basically, when I got back, I did the calculation. My old house in Toronto is heated with natural gas. And I calculated when I got back that my round trip flight to Lisbon and back, you produced as much carbon dioxide as my house produces in 6 months of heating, half a year's worth of heating. So it's actually a very big impact flying. If my house had been a passive house, because they are super insulated with high quality windows and use almost no energy at all to heat, my flight to the passive house conference would have produced more CO2 than my passive house would probably in 5 years. So the thing about it is that you have to sit and think, well, What did I just do here? I'm spending my time talking about reducing my carbon footprint and just added to it in an extremely significant way.
And with streaming technologies of these conferences, as a major features of these conferences, it seems like it's come down to the conferences being mostly networking opportunities, because you don't need to be at this conference that's being streamed online.
Well, absolutely. Last year for the conference in Portugal, they asked me to participate, and I'd put together a slideshow and I filmed it and put a video audio over it and sent it, and they liked it, which is why they asked me to come back this year in person. And it was a far more enriching experience to be there and meet all the people. And it was also incredibly wonderful to see a city like Lisbon that I'd never been to before and mix in another culture and climb the stairs and see how people live. Travel is an incredibly life-enriching and broadening thing. And it's much more than just looking at a video of a conference. You meet people, you see stuff, you eat great food. Travel is a great experience, but we have to figure out a way how to do it on a more carbon efficient way. Just flying over and flying back, as so many people do, for 3 days of talking to people, this is something that I think is seriously problematic.
Yeah, it's surely not sustainable to fly everybody overseas every time we need to talk about a particular topic or want to get together.
Especially when you're talking about reducing your footprint.
Exactly. So consumers have been feeling the crunch when it comes to our food distribution, and the romaine lettuce recall has really hit a lot of us hard. I just went to a salad bar, which probably, I imagine, half of their base product is romaine lettuce, and they had a little sign saying, "Sorry, we're out of romaine lettuce," and it's still being kept off the shelves all across North America. I love eating lettuce, and it's been
right.
It's been a staple of my diet for decades. But you have a piece entitled "Lettuce is Stupid and You Shouldn't Be Eating It Now Anyway." And you call it it's little more than a vehicle to transport refrigerated water from farm to table. And it was pretty eye-opening. Why don't you tell us what you learned about lettuce?
Well, the problem with lettuce is it is fabulous, and I love salad too. But lettuce, when it's grown locally in season, there are a lot of things that happen when it's grown locally in season. First of all, it's grown in smaller plots, so that if something gets contaminated, it doesn't contaminate very many people, and it's a small geographic area. You can find out where it is pretty quickly. The trouble is that when we basically nationalized production of eating stuff out of season so that all of this stuff comes from California, where lettuce takes a huge amount of water to grow, and as I said there, it's 94% water anyway that's being just shipped across the country and is ultimately just sort of a vehicle to get sauce, to get salad dressing, which is full of the flavor to your mouth. I mean, that's what it is.
Yeah, you say that a head of iceberg lettuce has the same water content as a bottle of Evian.
Yes. And the Evian doesn't have to be refrigerated to ship across the country.
Ah, that's a good point.
So, you know, the thing is, for years, when my wife used to work for one of the companies that... one of the websites that was partnered with Treehugger. Where do you live? Where are you based?
I'm in San Francisco.
San Francisco. Okay. Well, up here in Canada, 150 years ago, people ate a local diet. And that meant in the wintertime, you ate turnip and potatoes and parsnip and more turnip and more potatoes and meat. You ate a diet that didn't need refrigeration and didn't need transportation. And for a few years, we lived that 19th century Ontario diet. And you grew used to different kinds of potatoes and different kinds of turnip and sweet potatoes and other root vegetables. And when asparagus popped up in the spring, it was so marvelous. And when strawberries popped up in the spring, they were just so delicious because you hadn't had them in so long. Now, we get this stuff year-round, grown in the Central Valley or grown in Arizona, shipped all over. We have a diet that barely changes with the seasons. And the cost of it in terms of water, in terms of carbon, in terms of freight is high. But we've seen recall after recall over the last 10 years of, you know, the bagged lettuce a few years ago for E. coli and the romaine now for E. coli. And there's another big recall right now for listeria, where millions of pounds of meat are getting recalled. That for health, carbon, and water reasons, we really have to start thinking more about a more local and more seasonal diet.
So you've written some terrific articles recently, and I highly recommend our listeners go on to treehugger.com and search out some more of your work. Lloyd Alter, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
It was a real pleasure.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Souls of Mischief, Stephen Stills, and Little Feet.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week, as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.